Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
That people may like to use as an aid to what sort of questions they'd like to ask about. I'll just put these up at the beginning just in case there are things you wanted to ask about any of those topics or anything. In fact, obviously Herceptin's been in the news a lot lately, as have the aromatase inhibitors, whether in the adjuvant setting or in the extended adjuvant setting after completion of tamoxifen. There's a lot of interest in MRI, both preoperatively for staging disease within the breast and also in high-risk women, especially gene carriers. The issue of exercise after breast cancer has been in the literature a lot lately. Is digital mammography any better than standard mammography? The ongoing concern about treatment of menopausal symptoms, and a little bit, if anyone's got any questions about some of the complementary and alternative treatments. Just quickly to start with mentioning GPs, because I think they sometimes get, well, certainly from our point of view, and once you get sucked into the hospital system, get a little bit forgotten sometimes. Two-thirds of all referrals with a potential diagnosis of breast cancer come from GPs, and patients obviously have an ongoing relationship often with their GP, who are a source of support both for the patient themselves and the whole family. Referral decision may initially depend on, has a diagnosis of breast cancer already been made? Because a lot of GPs will have certain surgeons that they will refer as standard if the patient has a diagnosis of breast cancer. And that may be different to who from whom they would refer patients who they think has got benign disease. So is the referral with a diagnosis of breast cancer, or is it for an opinion, diagnostic purposes, or even a second opinion? Decisions that need to be made both jointly by the patient, their family and the general practitioner, who should the patient be referred on to, where should they be referred to, both geographically and where, meaning in the private or the public sector, and when, is there any urgency in the matter? The things that might influence the individual patient are obviously personal experience, if they've had personal previous experience with benign breast disease or even previous breast cancer, who the GP normally refers to, and importantly, personal recommendations from family and or friends who may have been through breast cancer. Increasingly, patients are taking it upon themselves, women are taking it upon themselves to do personal research about who they should be referred to, looking at caseloads, etc. And I'll come back to that a little later. What sort of factors are going to influence the patient? Patient factors about their decision. The age and sex of the patient is important, the background, the patient's occupation, whether they've got any medical knowledge, whether they're an allied health professional. Cultural and language issues may come into play. Patients may request to be referred to somebody who speaks their own language. Their educational level, how much understanding they have about breast cancer and what treatment might involve prior to actually seeing anyone. And finally, their social circumstances, number of dependents, etc., will influence whether they are willing to travel a distance for treatment, whether they prefer to have all their treatment locally, and finally, their financial circumstances. What factors about the surgeon may affect whether a woman wants to see a surgeon of that type? The sex of the surgeon, which we've just discussed, may influence some women's decision. The surgeon's style. You're not expected to become friends, but you don't want to go and see someone who makes your skin crawl. And for that reason, if you have a personal recommendation, that is often quite helpful. Their age and their degree of experience, the degree of specialisation, and what sort of work environment they live in, i.e. are they part of a multidisciplinary team? Where do they practice? Do they have both public and private appointments, etc.? some women do prefer to see a female surgeon. There was a questionnaire study done in Scotland where patients were asked specifically, would you prefer to see a male or a female breast surgeon? And the majority, as you can see, had no preference. Those who expressed a preference all would prefer to see a female surgeon. The women who expressed a preference were generally younger, in fact, compared to the people who had no preference. The style, as we touched on, again, this is maybe only something that you will get to know once you've met the surgeon, and you may say, well, it's too late. But again, from your GP, etc., you may find out whether the bedside manner, if you like, for want of another description. Some people prefer a paternalistic type surgeon who will give the information and tell them what's to be done. Other people would prefer a more interactive experience. And GPs often know that. They can tell from the letters they get from us. They can tell from having met us the style of practice. And they will often refer to different people with different patients, select this patient will probably be a good match with that surgeon, etc., etc. And this is one of my bugbears, surgeons who continually run late. I know in the public outpatient clinic people are seen, in priority. I personally don't think there's any excuse for that in private. You shouldn't be continually running late. You shouldn't be continually overbooking patients. It irritates me, and there's almost this air of, I'm running late because I'm so important. I mean, no one's that important. You should be able to organise your time. So, I mean, occasionally people are held up and occasionally people will be running late. But that is if that's a constant fixture, I think that's a fault in time management myself. There are also the sort of, as I touched on before, you may not just like the surgeon. And at that point, because this is going to be an ongoing relationship and, with good prognosis of breast cancer, etc., it's likely that that relationship will go on for many years. It is quite an important decision because you're going to be seeing that patient, that person on a regular basis for potentially quite a number of years. Some women will have a preference for an older surgeon or versus a younger surgeon, depending on what they perceive as their degree of experience. And that goes on to the issue of specialisation. There is, and I won't go through all of those figures there for you, but there's strong evidence that the outcome is better for if you see a specialist. And it's been looked at in a variety, it's been looked at in the UK, it's been looked at in America, and it's been looked at in Australia. And patients, surgeons who have a higher caseload have better survival rates than patients who have a low caseload. And there have been a lot of theories as to why this is the case. Usually patients who are doing more breast cases have a greater interest in it. They may have specialist training, but primarily they're usually involved in a multidisciplinary team, and that may affect the percentage of patients that they refer on for adjuvant treatment, etc. Interestingly, the figures have only just recently been replicated in Australia. They looked at surgeons who performed less than 20 operations a year versus more than 20 for breast cancer. And those who had a higher caseload, the patient was more likely to retain the breast, more likely to be referred on for adjuvant radiotherapy, and there was a survival advantage, a third more likely to be alive at 4 years. That cartoon there, which hasn't shown up very well, no, I haven't performed the operation myself, but I've seen it done successfully on ER and Chicago Hope, that is of relevance with sentinel node biopsy, etc., and with new technology. You do want to have some degree of confidence that the surgeon that you're seeing knows what they're doing. We've chopped off the bottom of this here, but basically this what I'll talk about next is along the same lines, but talking about multidisciplinary teams in breast cancer care. That's regarded now worldwide as an obligatory standard of care, that patients should be treated within a multidisciplinary team. The National Breast Cancer Centre have got guidelines, they've got published a lot of literature, and there's a lot of information on the subject. I think there's no doubt that the outcome is better for patients who are treated within a multidisciplinary team. That's just a definition of a multidisciplinary care. An integrated approach to healthcare in which medical and allied health professionals consider all relevant treatment options and collaboratively develop an individual treatment plan for each individual patient. Again, a bit like the specialisation, I think the evidence is clear. There is proof that the outcome is better if you're treated within this multidisciplinary setting. It's not always well received. You can implement multidisciplinary care in a compulsory nature within the public sector. It's been slightly less avidly picked up in the private sector for a variety of reasons, one of which is remuneration. Some of the older surgeons, and it's not only age, but some surgeons particularly are a little reluctant, sort of if it ain't broke, don't fix it type of model, and aren't all that keen to be involved in multidisciplinary care, especially in the private sector. And then there are people who think they're practicing multidisciplinary care, but in actual fact, they're making a decision and then referring on to someone else on the basis of their decision, in that you can't call it multidisciplinary care if the surgeon decides, I won't refer you on for radiotherapy without any discussion with anyone else. And then there's obviously the issue of people working at cross purposes if they're not actually meeting together. Where do you want to be treated? And that's a decision that's not irreversible, but it's something that some thought has to be given to initially. It does affect the choice of doctor. There's no doubt, unfortunately, that it may have some impact on the speed of access to seeing the surgeon initially, and more often, you know, your ease of access to inpatient care. We were discussing with Helen and Di just before we started, traditionally there's been less access in the private sector to adequate breast care nurse cover, but again, that's something I think that's improving with time. Certainly in our private service, we have full-time breast care nurse cover without out of hours, contact by mobile phone, etc. Your decision may impact on the ability to access diagnostic tests rapidly, the ability to select the surgeon who will actually perform the operation. Obviously, most public hospitals are teaching hospitals, and whilst in Australia, in the public sector, it is very much a consultant-led type situation. Registrars don't operate unsupervised, but most public hospitals are teaching institutions. And continuity follow-up is the other one. The nature of the surroundings, some people may feel intimidated, that's just a picture of the waiting room at Peter Mac, may prefer not to, when they're in a vulnerable state, be in a crowded waiting room with male, female patients, etc. Other people may not mind. I mean, it's very much up to personal preference. The other things that may affect your decision are the communication with your GP. The flexibility maybe in one sector or the other to be able to be more able to offer repeated visits and to fit in after hours or before hours with availability of relatives and the availability of theatre time, specifically the ability to coordinate if a second surgeon is necessary, say, for example, if you're having a complicated immediate reconstruction, etc. And then the issue of access to clinical trials in the private sector, whether there is access. Financial issues obviously do come into play because women will often need time off work, and it depends on their arrangements with their employer, whether they have disability insurance, etc. I think it's mandatory if you are treated in the private sector that patients are given informed consent about what their likely out-of-cost expenses are to be. And the final question regarding referral, when? Is there any medical urgency? And the answer is almost invariably no. In terms of delays, obviously there've never been and never will be any trials looking specifically at delay, but there have been several meta-analyses looking at inevitable delay where patients have concealed the diagnosis or the GP has missed the cancer or for whatever reason. And from those, it appears that probably 3 months is perhaps the watershed, that a delay of 3 months or more has been shown to be associated with a poorer long-term outcome. We're certainly comfortable in saying to patients that a delay of a matter of a couple of weeks, several weeks, is not going to affect their long-term outcome. There is no evidence. Certainly, a lot of patients from the psychological point of view, as soon as they have a diagnosis, like to make a decision and get on with it. My personal feeling is that a lot of these decisions, especially in younger women perhaps sometimes, that these are decisions that they're going to have to live with lifelong. And I think it's important to make each individual patient understand that it's more important in my mind to take the time to make the decision, discuss it with your family, discuss the implications, decide whether you want a reconstruction or not, decide if your premenopausal and you're thinking about further pregnancies, whether you want to have eggs stored or whatever, all those various issues that come into play are not going to, a delay of that amount of time is not going to impact on the final outcome. The other thing I've just put in here, because it's not particularly talked about a lot in this country, it is elsewhere, is the issue of timing of surgery in the cycle in premenopausal women. The evidence is mixed. The trials are pretty much half and half, but there are some women who, having armed with that information, will prefer to have their operation on certain days of the cycle. Certain trials have shown that certain times in the cycle are associated with a better prognosis than others in premenopausal women. But as I said, it's not ironclad, and the problem is sometimes that can lead to a delay of about 3 weeks. And I mean, whilst, as I've said, a delay of 3 weeks probably doesn't matter, I personally don't think the evidence is strong enough to advise women to go down that track. If someone feels strongly about it themselves, I'm happy to comply. But I don't think at this point we have enough evidence that it is advantageous. As I said before, about making the initial decision, you may make a rush decision. Everyone is entitled at any stage during their treatment to seek a second opinion. How you go about that, the best way generally is to go back to your general practitioner. A lot of surgeons that I certainly, if I think the patient's, you know, unsure, or especially if you're advising something relatively radical surgically, the most common thing being a woman who's has DCIS, an impalpable abnormality picked up at screening, who's got widespread DCIS, and they're told, yes, you have pre-invasive disease, but by the same token, they're advised that a mastectomy is the appropriate option. It's often, you know, it is a radical operation, and it is sometimes difficult for women to understand immediately why, for a pre-invasive disease, we're advising relatively radical surgery. And I would, in that situation, you know, actively encourage someone to seek a second opinion. If people are referred to me for a second opinion, unless the relationship with the original surgeon has broken down incontrovertibly, or they've come to see you because they weren't happy with the original surgeon, I think a second opinion should be just that, an opinion. The GP refers the patient to you. You give an opinion on what has been said and what you think is the advisable treatment, and then the patient should be encouraged to go back to their original surgeon. A lot of women will seek a second opinion just for confirmation that that what the first person they've seen has said is a reasonable thing, which is fine. I think if your doctor, you get the impression the doctor's not happy with you asking for a second opinion, I think that's a bad sign. That nobody should be hurt, angry, or anything like that for people who ask for a second opinion. The only situations in which I personally get a bit annoyed is some people, I think, have been told by relatives, ask for a second opinion, and you haven't even got the first opinion out. And you're like, look, I haven't even given you my opinion before you're asking for a second one. But I think it's perfectly reasonable, even going to see a third person. What about the person who refuses traditional treatment? It's a difficult issue. Obviously, I think it's incumbent upon ourselves to ensure and confirm that the patient has taken on board all the information they've been given, that they understand and they're making an informed decision. I think any sort of cognitive or psychiatric condition that may be affecting their decision making should be excluded. If the family can be involved, especially during the consultation, I think that makes it easier. I would especially persuade the patient to obtain a second traditional opinion in that situation. Obviously, for our own protection, all of that, those consultations need to be very documented very thoroughly. And I think it should be made clear to the patient, especially those who go off and seek alternative treatment, you know, go over to Perth, or, you know, in the past to see Dr. Holt, etc., that they're obviously very welcome to return. But if they do return, some ground rules need to be established. I think it's not appropriate for patients, and it's not usually a surgical issue, but for patients to have one cycle of chemo and then say, I won't have any more, and then come back, I'll just have one more. I think patients need to understand that chemotherapy is a package and you have to have your four cycles or whatever for it to be of any benefit to you. Going on to the medical issues, the first one obviously is establishing, confirming and communicating potentially the diagnosis, and then together with the patient developing a treatment plan. the first step after a clinical examination by either your GP or the specialist or through screening is obviously mammography, which, as I'm sure you all know, can be not the great, the most comfortable experience for everyone. The next step is almost invariably an ultrasound and some form of obtaining tissue for diagnosis. That's obviously a freehand fine needle aspirate being taken of a palpable lump on the left, and on the right there's a needle going through, and increasingly we're using image-guided biopsies. I explain to the patient that I tend to use either core biopsy these days or both. Cytology is fabulous because it's quick, it's easy, it's on the spot, but the patient needs to understand that it sometimes can give us less information than a core biopsy. Basically, cytology, as I'm sure you know, is just looking at the cells, and all the pathologist can say is, are they normal or are they not normal, and the degree of abnormality. They can't distinguish between invasive disease and pre-invasive disease, which is one of the drawbacks when you're planning surgical treatment, especially with respect to the axilla. Core biopsies, as I said, increasingly used. It's an office procedure. We've got one in the rooms. It's, you know, the patients are in and out. It takes 2 minutes. And that has the advantage that it gives the pathologist a tissue sample. They can say this is, you know, they can grade the tumour. They can do hormone receptor status, which it is quite helpful sometimes to know preoperatively. Going on to communicating the diagnosis, sometimes, as we've said, the diagnosis will have been made, the GP will have generated the tests, and a core biopsy may have been done outside and the GP has already communicated the diagnosis, or the tumour's been diagnosed through the screening program. I think, as a general rule, if the diagnosis has been communicated to the patient in a specialist setting, you should have a breast care nurse present. The patient should be invited to have a relative or a support person of some description present, if they so wish. A lot of people don't want someone present, and I mean, obviously that's the patient's decision. It is important to get some degree of understanding of the patient's knowledge of breast cancer, whether that be through friends and relatives' experience or, you know, maybe medical knowledge themselves, because that does alter how you pitch the ensuing discussion. It should be done clearly in private surroundings. You should not have interruptions. For women who don't speak English, an interpreter should be provided, and wherever possible, attempt to avoid jargon. There's the issue of audio taping of the consultations. I offer patients if they want it. It is easier if the patients have been pre-diagnosed to offer an audio consultation. It's more difficult to get to the fact that I've got news for you, do you mind if I tape it, because you're sort of letting the cat out of the bag before you've started. Certainly a results consultation, I think, is quite valuable sometimes, because inevitably these days where patients are given more information, there are a lot of things that are said in that consultation, a lot of medical details that the patient may wish to listen to again. In terms of diagrammatic aids, I think the standard ones that the drug companies provide as an information sheet, draw on that, and on the flip side of that, it's got details about the grade of the tumour, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's useful to offer the patient, if they want to, a lot of patients don't, an opportunity to see the imaging when you're explaining what form of surgery is perhaps most appropriate. This mammogram here, the one on the left, there are two tumours there, and on this view here, there's a lot of calcification, and patients can readily understand that it's not going to be feasibly possible to remove those two tumours, that volume of tissue, and leave an acceptable cosmetic result with breast conservation. And I think it is useful to see the imaging to have that confirmed if you are being faced with the prospect of a mastectomy. It's also the reverse instance. It's also useful to explain to patients who've maybe got a small area of DCIS there that that area really is very tiny and that is very appropriately treated by breast conservation. If you've got something of that size, unless the patient for whatever reason preferred a mastectomy, that probably surgically, the most appropriate option is going to be breast conservation. I think it's a good idea to stop the consultation if the patient is becoming increasingly distressed or clearly overwhelmed. We all know that 50% or more of the information that's conveyed after the diagnosis, if that original consultation's, probably needs to be repeated again at another time. So I think if that is happening, the best thing to do is abort get the patient back on another day. It doesn't need to be, it could be the next day or even later that day, but give them a time to collect themselves. Patients should be given appropriate written literature to take away. The ones down the bottom, obviously every patient in Australia who's diagnosed with breast cancer should be offered a copy of the National Breast Cancer Centre booklet. Increasingly we're using videos, especially for the reconstruction, breast reconstructions, and obviously women are using the internet a lot. I think, again, at an overwhelming time, it's quite helpful if we're able to give patients access to some recommended websites, because if you put in breast cancer into the Google, it's, you know, hopeless. Also, we would give patients information on how to obtain the My Journey kit. I think patients should be allowed to collect themselves in private prior to leaving. You don't want them walking through the outpatient clinic clearly upset and distressed. And it is helpful, I think, to spend some time alone prior to leaving with the breast care nurse, because there are often things that patients, as you know, will raise with the breast care nurse that they probably may feel reluctant or unwilling to raise with the surgeon, or even raise in the presence of other people, you know, even the partner, etc. I think if you've done a procedure and given a diagnosis, it's incumbent on us to check that the patient's well enough physically to get home, to get on public transport or drive or whatever. And if the patient's come alone and it's a surprise diagnosis, I think they should be offered the opportunity for us to contact someone and get that person to come in and wait for them, etc. I usually suggest to patients that they write a list of questions at that stage before next time I see them, because patients get nervous and at the time and forget things. And then think the minute they leave, you leave the room, you think, oh, I meant to ask that. I routinely offer patients a copy of any results, whether it be imaging or pathology, but I think especially with the operative pathology result, you need to take time to explain things to the patients about the operative pathology if you're going to give them a report. I offer it. Most patients take it. Some don't. They're not going to want to read it. They don't care. But I think if you're going to give it to them, you need to explain, especially things like the margins, because patients understand, obviously, that margins are important, etc. And from the surgical point of view, there are certain margins we may not take into account, the front margin, etc. And so if it says that a margin's positive, it's not. If it's not one we would regard as requiring further surgery, the patient should be told about that, so that they go home and read through it very thoroughly. They think, oh, they told me the margins were clear. So it needs to be adequately explained. And I'm quite interested in the concept of offering to copy the correspondence to the patient, into the correspondence that you send to back to the GP and on to any other specialist, so that the patient has time to reflect on that and also is reassured by the fact that there's no, what you're telling them is what you're telling everyone else, that you're not necessarily you're not withholding any information. That's just our breast care nurse's office. There's a spot to watch videos and all the usual literature. I think it is helpful to have a room away from the consulting room where the patient can go that's not under direct vision and hasn't got windows, etc., so that they can, if they want to, just have a cup of tea or coffee in there. The other thing I think it is important to warn patients about is a lot of people they know may have had an experience with breast cancer and they may not have been aware of it. People come out of the woodwork when you've had a diagnosis of breast cancer and everyone's got their two bobs worth, some of which is helpful, some of which isn't. And I think patients should be warned not to take too personally any information they're given. That, I mean, the standard advice I would give is that breast cancer, as you know, is a very heterogeneous disease. Just because that happened to Mrs. So-and-so's relative and she was deceased in 6 weeks, that is got nothing to do with the situation you're in. And that if people are being unhelpful and unfeeling and insensitive in their advice, just say to them, no, look, I don't need to hear that. You've got to be quite, I think patients have to be quite, try to be quite firm at that time and put yourself first. And also, whilst there's obviously useful information in the media, to ask the doctor or the breast care nurse or your GP for their take on some of the things in the media. Obviously, the print media is probably more reputable, but a lot of the current affairs programs have their own slant on things and it may not be helpful in that situation. Having discuss the diagnosis, obviously the next issue is the treatment plan. What factors might affect the patient's decision about what sort of treatment they're having? The age, the patient's social circumstances, whether they've got a very physical job, etc., may affect whether you want to have an immediate reconstruction. As I touched on before, their reproductive history and their reproductive aspirations in younger women, they may want to, and I would always encourage younger women who are thinking of that to go off and see one of the fertility doctors if they're thinking about storing eggs or having IVF. The other thing that people ask about and may even affect the surgical decision is the family history. If it appears from the family history that there's a high possibility of a genetic mutation, whether it's been proven or not, it may be reasonable to at least discuss in broad terms the issue of prophylactic surgery and more radical surgery if the patient's a gene carrier. I'm not saying that we would steer patients in that direction, but it's something that may need to be taken into account. Obviously, their general shape and size and their general health comes into play. And then secondly, and equally as importantly, the tumour factors. I've only put that up in there because of, to remind me about HRT and the issue of whether you should stop HRT cold turkey the minute of the diagnosis or whatever. I'm reasonably flexible about it. There's not an awful lot of evidence that continuing it in the immediate preoperative phase is deleterious. Some women have acute withdrawals. They get a withdrawal bleed when they're in hospital. I usually leave it up to the patient's discretion. Most women stop it. But I think for the woman who has stopped it in the past and had very disabling menopausal symptoms and restarted it for that reason, who doesn't want to stop it, I don't feel strongly that they should be put under pressure to stop it. In terms of the sort of general discussion about treatment of breast cancer, I usually go through the standard. There are three modalities: surgery, radiotherapy, drug therapy, and drug therapy can be chemotherapy and or endocrine therapy. And the decisions regarding what we call the adjuvant treatments, radiotherapy and drug therapy, are generally or often not made until you have the operative pathology to hand. I make all patients aware, obviously, who are having breast conservation, that they're very likely to be advised to have post-operative radiotherapy to the breast. And these days, we'd always talk about the sequencing of treatment. As you're aware, with early breast cancer, the commonest sequencing is surgery first, followed by the other treatments. But increasingly, neoadjuvant chemotherapy preoperatively in an attempt to either downstage the tumour to make it suitable for breast conservation or in more locally advanced tumours is being used. And so I think patients who have a tumour that may be suitable for neoadjuvant chemotherapy, that issue should be raised with them. I'm sure you're all aware of the surgical options available. Wide local excision, a wire for impalpable tumours, a quadrantectomy with or without filling of the resulting defect, and total mastectomy with or without reconstruction, whether that be immediate or delayed. With the axilla, the options are axillary clearance and sentinel node biopsy, essentially in this country. Axillary sampling never really took off in Australia, and I think sentinel node biopsy has overshadowed that, certainly. This is the time where they say, look away now on the news if you're squeamish. They're not particularly graphic, but just to give an example of good cosmetic results that you can get with breast conservation surgery, I'm sure you'd all agree that's a good cosmetic result. These are thankfully out of a textbook, but I think sometimes it is difficult to explain to patients what a poor cosmetic result can potentially look like, and the judgment call does tend to have to be, to a certain degree, from the surgeon, who by experience will know that certain tumours in certain positions are going to get a poor cosmetic result. And I think the patient should be warned about that preoperatively so that they can make a decision. Do they want some form of staged procedure where that hole is filled, or do they want rather, would they rather say, okay, if it's going to look like that and you're going to have to do a procedure to fill it, maybe I'd prefer to have a mastectomy. I'll pass over these pretty quickly in terms of moving skin around. Quickly on sentinel node biopsy, it's still in the current National Breast Cancer Centre booklet described, which is only 2 years old, I think. It just shows how quickly things have moved. it's still in that described as a experimental tool or trial tool. I think it's moved beyond that. There's in fact been a position statement released, I got it in the mail yesterday, by the College of Surgeons, basically outlining the fact that Sentinel Node is now accepted standard practice outside trial situations. Most people in Victoria would use a triple technique, a preoperative lymphoscintigram done in the nuclear medicine department with a lympho with a hard copy made, intraoperative injection of blue dye, and intraoperative use of a gamma probe. Under what circumstances surgically would we steer somebody towards mastectomy? I think it's important to emphasise to women that just because you've been advised to have a mastectomy doesn't necessarily mean that your tumours have a worse prognosis. And it's a reasonably easy concept to grasp. Obviously, it depends on the size of your tumour versus the size of your breast. If you've got a small tumour, moderate-sized tumour in a very small breast, you're not going to get a satisfactory result from conservation. That issue that I discussed before of widespread DCIS or precancerous change. If for some reason there's a contraindication to radiotherapy in an individual person, we would usually advise against breast conservation. For example, somebody who may have had previous radiation, maybe they had Hodgkin's disease or something like that, somebody who has issues regarding not being able to be absent, if you're a rural person who, for whatever reason, is not prepared to spend the time in a regional centre to have the 5 or 6 weeks of radiation. I think people who are making a decision about conservation versus mastectomy on the basis of avoiding radiotherapy for practical reasons need to be thoroughly informed that there are certain circumstances post-mastectomy where radiotherapy will be advised. I think probably across the board, maybe 20% of women who have a mastectomy will be advised to have radiation in addition. So what you don't want to happen is somebody to have a mastectomy that maybe doesn't need one and then find out they need radiation as well. So I think patients need to be aware of that. Multiple cancers in one breast, as that mammogram I showed you before, generally not suitable for conservation, and large locally advanced cancers. And the other issue is recurrent breast cancer. Our normal advice, if somebody has breast conservation and radiation and they get a recurrence, it's almost invariable that we would advise at that point to have a mastectomy. It's not unreasonable for the patient to have a further wide local excision, but that needs to be on the understanding that they probably are risking a reasonable chance of a further recurrence. All patients who are having a mastectomy there should be a discussion about the availability or otherwise of reconstruction and the advantages and disadvantages of, if you're having a reconstruction, having it at the time of your original surgery or subsequently. This is, I think, quite a useful slide, not even from the surgical point of view. It's almost more relevant in terms of making decisions about HRT and endocrine treatment and adjuvant treatment. Every decision's got a risk-benefit analysis, and I think it is useful for patients to be, you know, the suggestion be made that you write down a list. You know, if you've got a long list on one side and a short list on the other, it makes the decision making a little bit easier. I like this one. I think the communication with yourself and not only the surgeon but all the other health professionals is essential. You need to be confident they've understand where you're coming from as much as we need to know that you've understood what we've said. That's it really for the body of the talk. If there are any issues along those topics you wanted to ask or anything else, just going on to Herceptin, which obviously has had a lot of publicity in the last week with the publication last week of the data from the adjuvant trials. I think the key take-home message is that it's only even an option for 20%, the 20% of women who are HER2 positive. And the issue as to the cost problem is one that's going to remain in the public eye. There will be obviously a lot of pressure to bear. But unfortunately, speeding up the TGA and PBS approval is not going to happen overnight, I think, being realistic. MRI, the expertise in Australia, there are MRIs available and breast MRIs. The problem at the moment in Australia is the expertise with respect to interpretation of them. A lot of benign abnormalities are picked up, and from that point of view, I think for the time being, it's likely to be only offered in a screening setting for people who are deemed to be at very high risk. You do get lots of films to look at, as you can see there. And I think with time, it's going to become very useful. But for the time being, it's only for a selected few. Exercise. There was a very interesting article, trial published earlier this year in the American Medical Journal, which showed that one of the things you can do to reduce your risk of recurrence is exercise. They showed that there was a survival advantage in women who performed the equivalent of between 3 and 5 hours of walking per week. And that seemed to be mainly in hormone receptor positive tumours. So it's just food for thought, really, that. Digital mammography. Peter Mack's got the only digital machine in Victoria. It has some advantages. There was a paper published in the last fortnight or so which showed for the first time that it is probably a little bit better than traditional screen filming in women with very dense breasts. The big advantage from the practical point of view is that you have the ability, like with the digital camera, to alter the images, and you can blow it up and have a closer look, and you can archive films, and so you can look at last year's films, the year before, the pre-op films, all on the one screen. So I think from the actual technical point of view, it may be a bit better in dense breasts, who knows, but I think from the practical point of view, it's got a lot to offer, but it's still in the early phases, really.
How does it happen to you?
Exactly the same way.
Oh, right.
The only advantage is, though, that you're never going to be, because you get an instant picture like a digital camera, you're not left clamped in the machine while they
go and have a look.
Yeah. So that, I mean, it was felt that that would make it a lot more, a lot speedier. You would only have to allow a shorter period of time for each woman. That's probably not quite the case, but, I mean, that's one potential advantage.
So we're still going off to get squashed.
Yep. Pardon? Are any other hospitals going to? I think with time, certainly I would imagine that someone in the private sector will obtain one. They're, off the top of my head, I've got no idea. I think it was around 500,000. But I think in light of that paper that was published a couple of weeks ago, I think there are a lot of younger women who probably, I'm surprised it didn't get more media coverage because it was in the, it was in the New England Journal. It wasn't, it was in a respected publication. I think probably one of the private consortiums will obtain one. In the public sector, I'm not sure.
So it's probably a better option
for the elderly? Well, it may be. Mm-hmm. I mean, they showed equivalent detection rates for screening, but they had a better detection rate in younger women with dense breasts than with traditional film mammography. The eternal saga of what's safe and what's not and what's useful and what's not for menopausal symptoms goes on and on. Every year there's a new option available and the discussion goes along the lines, is it safe, does it work, sort of thing. At the moment, we're reasonably comfortable with progestogens, low-dose megase, and some of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. There's been a randomised trial done of venlafaxine, so that would tend to be the one most people would prescribe, and all the others as read. I think one thing to mention about tibolone, which is a synthetic form of HRT, it was the subject of a big marketing campaign by the pharmaceutical company that produced it, and its big selling point was it doesn't increase the risk of breast cancer. The Million Women study, which was one of the HRT studies, the UK one, did, however, show that the risk was higher in women on tibolone than women not on HRT. I mean, this was of causing breast cancer, not recurrence. No one's looked at recurrence, but and there is a trial going on looking at that. But in terms of causation of breast cancer, the highest risk was in women who are on combined estrogen and progesterone HRT, and it was lower on the estrogen only and on Livial, but it was still above average. Okay. Oh, I wasn't sure whether I had this in. This is just out of interest. Diagnostic delay for breast cancer is the commonest cause of litigation in the US. From our point of view, and from your point of view, the best way to reduce that is strictly adhering to a triple assessment. I give all patients that, which I think is a fabulous book on breast changes, the NBCC one, that goes through page by page about the concept of triple assessment, how many things are missed by triple assessment, and I give every patient, irrespective of whether they've got benign or malignant disease, that to take with them. It talks about, the fact that mammography can't pick up all cancers, et cetera, et cetera. And going on to the legal thing, the other breast claims for negligence are, and not necessarily that all of these would be defended, a false negative mammogram, a poor cosmetic outcome following a benign breast operation, false positive cytology, which thankfully is rare. That's one of the other reasons that people have moved to core biopsy in addition or instead of. The failure to refer someone on for adjuvant treatment, and the final one, which is another common thing, is the patient thinks there's a lump there, but the clinician's not impressed. Any patient who thinks they've got a lump, whether or not I think I can feel anything, I think gets imaging, irrespective. The negative predictive value of a normal mammogram and ultrasound is about 99%. That's therefore, you may say, well, why bother with triple assessment? You do pick up cancers that aren't visible on mammogram or ultrasound, but it is uncommon. If the patient thinks there's a lump there, just because you feel it, you can't feel it, doesn't necessarily mean there's not something there.
Does everyone know what triple assessment means?
No.
I brought some of the regular stuff that we give out with me. This particular book, which is the one I think is absolutely fantastic, is the produced by the National Breast Cancer Centre, and it goes through page by page how accurate is the triple test. The triple assessment is basically three modalities: clinical assessment, imaging, ultrasound, mammogram, whatever, and some form of pathological diagnosis, that whether it be cytology or a core biopsy. And I think if patients are given this, they can then make a decision as to whether they... Some patients don't want a needle test and they're happy to say, look, if you think it feels all right, it looks all right on the ultrasound, I'm happy to accept that, whatever percentage chance that it could be a cancer. But I think armed with this, if patients are given this and you explain what the concepts are, it's obviously then the patient's decision as to whether they would go ahead and have a needle test. As we were talking about basically extended adjuvant treatment with hormonal agents, our standard advice has been for women with hormone receptor positive tumours that they have 5 years of tamoxifen. The reason being that 5 years has been shown to be better than 2 years, but no one has shown that more than 5 years is of any additional benefit. And the long-term serious side effects of tamoxifen increase after 5 years, specifically endometrial cancer. With the newer class of endocrine agents, the aromatase inhibitors becoming available on the market, they're looking for their niche in the market, so to speak. The ATTACC trial, which put tamoxifen head-to-head with one of the aromatase inhibitors, anastrozole or arimidex, showed that the results aren't... They're out to almost 5 years, but they're not completely mature. Showed that arimidex appeared to be superior in terms of disease-free survival and recurrence, but they haven't shown an overall survival advantage as yet. So at the moment in this country, in the adjuvant situation, at the time of diagnosis, tamoxifen would still generally, in most cases, be the obvious choice, unless there was a reason why tamoxifen was inappropriate or the patient had took tamoxifen and didn't tolerate it. The next question that was raised was therefore, well, if tamoxifen stops working or there's no additional benefit after 5 years, what about trying one of the aromatase inhibitors after 5 years? And at the moment, gradually are reporting 3 or 4 or 5 trials looking at various combinations of swapping from tamoxifen to another agent, either at 2 years swapping to exemestane or after 5 years swapping to letrozole. The MA17 trial, which looked at swapping to letrozole after 5 years, its initial reporting has shown an improvement in overall survival in the node positive women. no survival advantage so far in the node negative women. Letrozole or Femara is made by Novartis, and they now have a program. It's not available for that indication on the PBS, but they have a program now that the company provide it free of charge to women if they want to swap from tamoxifen, go on to tamoxifen, from tamoxifen to letrozole after 5 years. From our point of view, I think it's reasonable for anyone who wants to take it after 5 years who's ER positive to swap to it. But in terms of what are your likely benefits, I think certainly in the node positive women, it is reasonable to strongly consider. Whether at the moment there's enough evidence to suggest going on to it for node negative women is unclear. The aromatase inhibitors as a group, because they completely suppress estrogen production, do lead to, in most cases, osteoporosis. And so they're not without side effects. And so in node-negative women who've had a very good prognosis tumour, for example, if you've had a 5mm grade 1 node-negative ER-positive tumour, probably the benefits of going on to letrozole after your tamoxifen are outweighed by the potential harm you may be caused, you know, especially if you have a history of osteoporosis. They're virtually identical. I mean, there's minor differences. Exemestane is a different class of aromatase inhibitor. It's a steroidal aromatase inhibitor, so it acts in a slightly different way. And it's, because it was sort of the last on the scene, it's finding the most difficult sort of where it's going to fit in the adjuvant setting. Certainly in the advanced setting, where you're sequentially working through them as, you know, a tumour may recur or whatever, exemestane would be third line. It would generally be these days either tamoxifen followed by one of the others, usually letrozole, then if there was recurrence, exemestane. Tamoxifen's cheap, obviously. The others, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. The
you only get a month's worth for the same price as you got, you know, 2 months worth of tamoxifen.
Mm. I mean, if you're buying, prior to the 1st of December last year, Arimidex wasn't available on the PBS in the adjuvant setting, and the cost was about between $200 and $300 a month.
Well, I sort of failed on tamoxifen, so.
Yeah. And letrozole's about the same price, yeah. But, I mean, now you can get Arimidex on the PBS, and you can get letrozole for that indication free, or, you know, apart from your pharmacy charges.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask a question. You mentioned before about the public sector and your choice of surgeon, feeling comfortable and all that with it. As a public patient, do you just have to, like, go with the flow? Like, you meet your surgeon, you feel comfortable with your surgeon, but then you go to the operating theatre. You said, well, I'm not going to actually be doing the surgery with this person, and I'll be watching. It's a bit like just sort of put the brakes on and say, well, no, I don't want this. I mean, it's just a legacy of the system, and you should be made aware of that up front. I mean, you build up this relationship with the surgeon, and then she doesn't do it after all. I mean, as I said, in this country where it is a consultant-led service, you can be assured that there'll be a consultant, you know, scrubbed
heavily supervising the operation. Whether they're actually holding the knife is the one that's open to discussion.
Part of the beginning of it, isn't it? Yeah. You've got this relationship with, you've built up, and now this unknown identity is going to be taking to you.
I
felt a bit uncomfortable with that factor.
Well, I mean, I guess that's one of the issues, the public versus the private sector. I mean, the trainees have to be taught.
It was an unknown.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe, and it's a difficult issue as to how it's tackled. You don't want to thrust information onto someone when they come into the hospital saying the person you've met might not be doing your operation. I mean, 9 times out of 10, let's face it, if I've seen a patient, whatever, 9 times out of 10, I will do the operation. But I think, as you say, patients in the public sector need to be made aware of the fact that, because it is a public hospital and is a teaching hospital. I mean, some public hospitals aren't teaching hospitals, and so, you know, the person you've met. The other thing is, and it doesn't tend to happen so much with breast cancer, because all breast cancers in this country are done fairly quickly. But for other types of surgery where you're put onto a waiting list, not only may it not be the surgeon you've met, it may be someone you've never even seen or met would be the consultant in charge, because a lot of general surgical units will have a joint waiting list, and so you may be seen by someone, and then, you know, so-and-so's got a spot on their list, and they say, oh, you know, that gallbladder patient can come onto my list. So I think breast cancer patients probably get a better deal from that point of view. It's very unusual for patients to be put on a joint list and swapped around. Most surgeons would have the patients that they'd seen, you know, for diagnosis and seen in outpatients, would at least be on their, under their supervision or on their operating list.
And why is it that your follow-ups are usually with your oncologist as opposed to your surgeon? If anything starts, it's your surgeon is the first port of call, but for, you know, maintenance checks and that, it's the oncologist, and then I suppose if something happens, you go back to the surgeon.
It depends on the individual, you know, how the individual unit works, and being realistic, it depends partly on staffing levels. Certainly, in most institutions, it would be evenly shared between the three modalities. If you've had surgery, radiotherapy and medical oncology, all three would follow you. And, I mean, the NHMRC guidelines, which, you know, most people would loosely adhere to in terms of follow-up, are that you're seen 3 monthly for 2 years, 6 monthly out to 5 years, and annually thereafter. And I mean, obviously that's tweaked around depending on your degree of risk and where you live and et cetera. But I mean, most people would work it out that you see the surgeon one visit, you see the medical oncologist the next visit, and you see the radiation oncologist the next visit after that. As a surgeon, I always prefer to see the patient at the 12-month visit when they're having their mammograms, because I think it's the surgeon's area of expertise and their responsibility to check that. I mean, I think personally that patients should be made aware of the reason that they're followed up and given, you know, hopefully written instructions about what to look for, etc. The reason that you see the surgeons in outpatients for follow-up is to detect local recurrence on the side that's been operated on and to keep the other side under surveillance. So the surgeon's really the primary person that's keeping, should be the primary person in my mind, and an eye on that sort of thing. It varies in some institutions. In my mind, the surgeon is the one who most often sees patients with breast cancer, you know, de novo, etc. I don't think personally medical oncologists and radiation oncologists are as good at surgeons as surgeons at detecting recurrence. And they see patients for different, I mean, when I say detecting recurrence, I mean in the breast. They're not as familiar as what a breast feels like, what a treated breast feels like. Medical oncologists see patients primarily in addition to doing those sort of checks, but to look at treatment-related morbidities and side effects of treatment and all that sort of thing, and similarly the radiation oncologist. So in my mind, the sort of the linchpin of the follow-up should be really the surgeon, because they're looking for something that can be treated. If you develop a local recurrence that, or you develop a problem in the other breast, that's early detection and that can be treated and, you know, successfully treated.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.